Let's start with a short meditation. So as always, we begin by preparing the body, setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. And then preparing the mind, setting it in a state of ease and relaxation. By letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. So let's now reflect on the disadvantages of the self-cherishing mind. And the more that we reflect on this, the more we will want to exchange the self-cherishing mind with the mind of cherishing others. So remember, the self-cherishing mind is the selfish, self-centered attitude that sees my happiness as more important than the happiness of anyone else. Everything revolves around me. Me and my happiness. So we can begin by reflecting on our own past experiences. So bring to mind some occasions in the past where you had this selfish, self-centered attitude. And see what effect it had on you and those around you. Did your self-cherishing attitude ever make you feel lonely or isolated? And by putting so much emphasis on our own happiness, does this self-cherishing attitude ever lead you to develop fear or anxiety by seeing things around you as a potential threat to your happiness? And as a result, Do you ever become overly sensitive and easily offended? And by paying so much attention to our own wants and needs, does this attitude lead you to develop craving and attachment towards things? And does this ever lead to any frustration when you don't get the things you want? And even if you get the things you want, are you ever completely satisfied? Or do you simply end up wanting more, craving for more? And do you ever become dissatisfied or disappointed when things don't live up to your expectations? And with this exaggerated sense of self-importance, does the self-cherishing mind ever lead you to have a lack of consideration and respect for others? And does this ever lead you to become jealous of those who seem to have more than you? And does this ever result in you becoming competitive with others, trying to outdo them and put them down? And does the self-cherishing mind ever lead you to be arrogant and dismissive of those who seem to have less than you, or be at a lower level than you. And by seeing everything from this very narrow perspective of how the situation merely affects me and my happiness, does the self-cherishing mind ever lead you to have attachment to friends? By seeing them as the source of your happiness. And does this also sometimes lead you to be apathetic or indifferent to strangers because they don't seem to affect your happiness in any way? And does this also sometimes lead you to be hostile or have anger or hatred towards difficult people, seeing them as the source of your suffering? And does this self-cherishing mind ever lead you to deliberately harm others who stand in the way of your happiness? So see self-cherishing as our real enemy and make a strong determination to overcome it and not allow it to take control of our mind and to replace and exchange this destructive self-cherishing attitude with the attitude of cherishing others. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. simply resting in awareness itself. All sorts of appearances will continue to arise, but now pay no attention to any appearance and simply rest within luminously clear awareness. Relaxed and alert. Open and spacious. And while remaining in that open, spacious state, we can slowly end the meditation and begin our discussions together today. So let's start with a review. So we have very clear what we've covered so far, so we can move ahead in the text. So again, we are using this 7-point mind training text. And here it says that the author is Geshe Chikawa from around the 12th century. In fact, all of the points that we are looking at in this text are actually coming from Lama Atisha, great Indian master who brought this system of Lojong to Tibet. But generally, Geshe Chikawa is listed as the author of this text because he was the one who systematized all of these various points into these all these various slogans into these 7 points. And we are following the commentary from one of his main disciples, Tse Chilbu, Chegi Geltsen. And so what we can say is that effectively the commentary is also by Geshe Jikawa, because this commentary is really just a collection of notes by Sechubu from the teachings he received from Geshe Jikawa. And this Lojong system of practice was flourishing very much in early Tibet. And there are many Lojong texts available, but probably the two main ones that you will see are this 7-point mind training and the 8 verses of mind training by Lungri Tampa. And this Lojong system of practice, of course, like every Buddhist system of practice, the two core areas of practice are the wisdom and compassion. And remember, this Lojong is within the Mahayana tradition. And the Mahayana is building on the foundation of the Four Noble Truths. So within the Four Noble Truths level of teachings, then remember the compassion wing of practice was usually described by the four immeasurables. Loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. We are trying to develop these four qualities towards immeasurable sentient beings, towards all sentient beings. So this is the foundation level of the compassion wing of practice. And on the wisdom wing of practice, the foundation level of the wisdom wing within the Four Noble Truths were these three marks of existence. Coming to realize impermanence, dukkha, and no self. And then on the basis of this wisdom and compassion at the Four Noble Truths level of teachings, then within the Mahayana, we sort of take both of those to another level. Meaning, we build on the four immeasurables in terms of developing bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment, for the welfare of others. And on the wisdom wing, we build on the impermanence, dukkha, and no self by developing this wisdom of emptiness. No independent me, no independent objective world. And then, within the 7-point mind training, we've already covered the first point. The first point, of course, was the preliminaries, the basis, the foundation. What sorts of practices do we need to engage in to have a good foundation for this Lojong practice of bodhicitta and emptiness? And there we saw that some of the core practices that we really need to have well developed were these four thoughts, the four thoughts that turn the mind. Reflecting on precious human life and death, to overcome laziness, to really appreciate what is important and meaningful in our life, and then to establish a basis of a meaningful life by reflecting on karma and thereby cultivating an ethical lifestyle, and then taking that to the next level by reflecting on dukkha, the fact that there is no genuine lasting happiness to be found out there, and that will help us to redirect our mind inwards. Instead of chasing after happiness out there and seeing the source of our suffering as being out there, we can turn our attention inwards to reduce and eliminate the real cause of our suffering, our mental afflictions, and then cultivate the causes of happiness within our own mind. And by doing these reflections, then, we have a good basis for going on to develop bodhicitta and then going on to develop the wisdom of emptiness. And so not only should we engage in these preliminary practices as a separate practice and be well practiced in them, but also in the text it suggests that at the beginning of each meditation session, we should also reflect on these, particularly these four points, to generate enthusiasm for our practice at the beginning of every session. So we should not see these preliminaries as some sort of trivial thing that we do a little bit when we're a beginner, and then we sort of forget about it and go on to more advanced practices such as emptiness and bodhicitta. Because if we don't continue to work on these preliminaries, we're going to forget them. We're going to become lazy with respect to our practice. We're going to get caught up in chasing after all sorts of sense pleasures. We're not going to have any opportunity for practice because we're going to be always distracted, having no time and energy to do anything meaningful. And then we looked at the second point. So that's where we are now in the seven points. The second point is the main practice, cultivating the two bodhicittas, the ultimate bodhicitta, which is the wisdom practice of emptiness, and the conventional bodhicitta, which is this compassionate mind of bodhicitta. And we saw there that, as with all practices, if a practice is going to be effective and we're going to progress in that practice, the practice has to have two components. An actual meditation session, where we internalize that practice, that whatever we are working on, and then the subsequent period practice, which is what we do for the rest of the day, that we need to integrate what we're meditating on in our daily life activities. So if we do these two things together, then we can most effectively progress in that practice. And we saw there that within the meditation practice, then whatever we're meditating on, it's very important to, at the beginning of the session, to prepare ourselves well. Preparing, not only having a good place to meditate, but then preparing the body, speech and mind so that we are in a very suitable state to be able to do the meditation. Having a good posture, relaxed body, quieting the mind, setting a good motivation, having an uplifted mind. And then we can engage in the meditation session. And also there mentioned was that it's very important to have a stable, clear mind to be able to do these meditation practices effectively. So there we had a little look at the shamatha practice, the practice of developing this calm, clear, focused mind. Because unless we put some effort into this practice, then none of our other practices, such as bodhicitta, emptiness, impermanence, dukkha, none of these other meditation practices are going to be very effective because our mind is going to be caught up in distraction and dullness. So we had a look at then how to go about developing this stable, clear, focused mind. And one thing there that I mentioned that is very important, but often not really much talked about in this shamatha practice, is the idea of relaxation. Because particularly I think in our modern society, many of us have very hectic, fast-paced lives, bombarded by stimulus. We tend to be very agitated and tense. And our minds tend to be very chaotic, meaning that whenever we want to focus on anything, we really forcibly clamp down on that. Otherwise, we just get completely distracted. So we have a lot of tension in our focus. So generally, in our daily life, when we want to be focused, we are quite tense. And then when we relax, we tend to be half asleep, very dull. So here, then, in meditation practice, we need to be alert and focused, but we need to at the same time be relaxed. So we really need to make sure that the basis of all of our meditation practices is a relaxed body and a relaxed mind. Otherwise, if we apply a tense mind to meditation, we're going to have all sorts of problems. We're going to get a lot of agitation, we're going to get very fatigued, and in extreme cases, we may even start developing headaches from meditating. And of course, if we apply this tension in our meditation practice, we're going to strengthen the habit of being tense when we're focused. And then the more we strengthen that, the harder it is to reverse that. So we really need to make sure that the first thing we develop in our shamatha practice is relaxation. Then, of course, we can stabilize the mind and make the mind more clear, focus on the object. And one other point that I mentioned there that is also very important, not only with the shamatha practice, but all meditation practices, is we looked at this fault of laziness. That this was actually the first fault in the shamatha practice. And again, we tend to be quite lazy when it comes to meditating in general. And of course, one of the very first things to do to overcome that laziness is these preliminary practices. Because we tend to be lazy with practice because we're so much caught up in all these other activities in life that seem to be so important to us now. But if we really reflect on our precious human life and death, we're going to start to see how a lot of these things that we fill up our life with are not very meaningful. They don't really bring us anything. We'll start to lose interest in them. And then we'll start to want to make our life more meaningful and develop ourselves. And then we can have some time and energy to meditate. But on top of that as well, then for every single practice we do, it's also very important to understand what the practice is and what benefits we will receive from the practice. Because if we simply do the practice because someone told us it's important to do, then of course we're probably going to be very lazy when it comes to doing that practice because we won't appreciate the benefits. Same as everything in our daily life. If we see no benefit in some activity, we're not going to put any effort into it. We're going to be very lazy. So if we reflect on the benefits of each practice and understand what it is, then we'll, of course, be very enthusiastic to do the practice because we see that it's going to benefit us immensely. So similarly here with the shamatha practice. So again, if you find yourself being very lazy with respect to a particular practice, it's usually because we haven't really reflected on the benefits. So this was the shamatha practice that we looked at. And again, with that practice, we can use one of many different objects. And again, the recommendation there is pick an object that works best for you. Generally, I think for most of us in our modern society, probably the breath is going to be the best object. But if you prefer to use the mind or resting in awareness or even a mental image or some other object, that is okay. Whatever is best, use that. Then, of course, we started to look at the actual practice, meditative practice of ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom practice. So remember, this is based on the wisdom practice, the vipassana practice at the Theravada or the Four Noble Truths level, primarily the wisdom of no self. So there, the wisdom of no self is to come to realize that this self does not exist. What do I mean by self? Is that we overinflate our sense of me. We really instinctively believe or experientially sense that there's something more than just the body and the mind here. There's this third thing, there's this me. This me that sort of stands a little bit apart from the body and the mind. The me that seems to be a little bit more than just the body and the mind. A me that really does seem to have autonomous, self-existent, substantial existence. And that's the me that we often relate to in our behavior, as if there's this sort of me here that's trying to run the show, trying to be the master or the controller of this body and the mind. But if we investigate closely, we'll see there's no such me here. That there's simply the body and the mind. There's nothing more than that here. There's no extra third thing, this self. So this is the wisdom we are trying to develop at the Four Noble Truths level. this no self, this no self-sufficient substantial me here. But here in the Lojong system, of course, this is within the Mahayana tradition, and we are taking this wisdom practice to a deeper level. So, of course, also within the Mahayana level, they would also accept there's no self, no self-sufficient substantial me. But in the Mahayana, it's accepted that there is a deeper level of ignorance than merely grasping onto that self. And that the deeper level of ignorance is believing there's an independent me here and an independent objective world out there. And so this is what the text then goes on to say. In the first part of the meditative practice of emptiness is to look at this world, this all the perceived world, investigate it, and see how these things really do exist. And so the slogan there is to train to view all phenomena as dreamlike. So dreamlike, of course, means how are all these things like a dream? Well, a dream is something that does not exist in the way it appears. And so this instruction is saying that also this phenomenal world that we apprehend is not existing in the way it appears, hence dream-like. And so, of course, things do really appear to us to exist independent of us. The world seems to be made up of many separate, discrete things, and that we are in no way contributing to the existence of this world of that we perceive. But as the commentary suggests, is that if we investigate this world, if we investigate these objects that we see, that we'll come to realize that they're mere appearances, and that there's not a single atom that exists as a reality separate from the mind. So, of course, what that means is that for something to be a mere appearance, it means that it is merely labeled, that things only exist within our conceptual framework, which means they are dependent phenomena, that not only everything we perceive depends on causes and conditions to exist, and of course everything depends on its parts to exist, but it also depends on imputation or labeling for it to exist. And the way we could understand that is that actually the phenomenal world is just a mass of sense data, and that to make sense of out of all of this data, we have to draw lines around various collections of data, we have to create an object out of that collection, and then of course we have to go on to give it a name or a label so that we can communicate with others. So we have to do this. We have to draw lines and give names in order to be able to have some meaning out of what we experience. But of course the problem is that we don't realize that's what's going on. We instinctively believe that the world is already divided up into many separate discrete things, meaning that we instinctively turn our line drawing into hard boundaries, that the world is full of boundaries, the world is full of many separate discrete things. But what's the problem with seeing the world in that way? As we saw, the problem with seeing the world in that way is that when we experience these objects, and then we have a pleasant or unpleasant experience with respect to them, that often leads to a lot of mental afflictions and suffering. For example, if I'm having a pleasant experience when I see a particular object, together with the belief that that object is existing there independent of me, then of course I will naturally go on to assume there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant experience, so I'll see it as inherently attractive. And of course, I like pleasant feelings, I want pleasant feelings, That object seems to be causing my pleasant feeling, so therefore I want that object. So that is attachment. Or alternatively, if we have an unpleasant experience, we'll see it is inherently unattractive. I don't want unpleasant feelings. That object seems to be causing my unpleasant feelings. Get it out of here. So that's aversion. And then what we can see is all of our other mental afflictions, such as jealousy and craving and fear, anxiety, resentment, depression, all of these come out of one of these two or a combination of them. And this is, of course, what's driving our behavior, leading to our suffering. So if we can come to realize that things are dreamlike, meaning they're not existing in the way they appear, there is no independent, inherently existent object there, i.e. realize emptiness, then there is no mental afflictions that are possible because of that. So by eliminating ignorance, we eliminate attachment aversion, all the mental afflictions and all the suffering that they produce. So this is the first of the slogans in terms of the emptiness practice, to see the phenomenal world or the perceived world as being dream-like, as being mere appearances, merely labeled. So therefore we can understand that this phenomenal world exists within our conceptual framework. It's really a product of our mind. But then, of course, we could then maybe go on to think, well, since everything's really a product of the mind, a projection of the mind, then the mind is the only real thing, because everything's coming from the mind. So to overcome grasping onto the mind as something substantial, then we have the second slogan here, which says, examine the nature of the unborn awareness. Meaning that if we apply the same investigation to the mind itself, we will also come to see that the mind is unborn, meaning not inherently produced, does not inherently exist. And thereby, by realizing that, we can come to realize that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence. And so these are the two slogans relating to the phenomenal world and then the mind that apprehends all of that. To come to realize emptiness, that nothing exists independently. Everything is dreamlike. Everything is a dependent arising. Everything is a mere appearance, is merely labeled. It's not findable amongst the bases. And then there's two more slogans there that go on to sort of explain how to sort of complete that investigation in meditation, which is the remedy too is freed in its own place, and then place your mind on the basis of all the actual path. So these two slogans are then saying that once we come to realize that the object of our investigation is not inherently existent, not independently existent, then we are to hold that experience. Because initially, of course, when we're investigating that particular object, we have the appearance of this independently, inherently existing object. And then we look for that object amongst the bases. And if we can't seem to find the object amongst the bases, then that not finding experience is this space-like experience of emptiness. So then we are to hold that experience of not finding as long as we can. And as the text says, not allowing our mind to fall under distraction and dullness. So there we are simply holding the experience of not finding, which of course is the experience of emptiness, as long as we can. So we can allow that to penetrate deeper into our mind. So remember then, yesterday we looked at the fact that in our emptiness practice, in fact all of our practices, we go through three stages. First, we need to have some intellectual understanding of the topic that we're going to meditate on, because we need some sort of framework for our practice. But then, of course, if we merely leave things at the intellectual level, meaning that if we're simply happy that we intellectually understand what impermanence is, what bodhicitta is, what emptiness is, then not much is going to really change in our life. In fact, we may become more frustrated, because now we sort of intellectually think that we've understood reality a little bit, and therefore maybe have this expectation, because I sort of understand reality now, my life should be a lot better. And then, of course, when it's not getting better, we may just get very frustrated and depressed, thinking that, oh, even though I understand reality, my life is a misery. And, of course, the problem here is that our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. It's driven by our instinctive habit. So if we want to take advantage of this intellectual understanding, if we want that to really improve our life, we need to go to the next level, meaning we need to internalize that intellectual understanding. We need to meditate to come to taste and experience what we intellectually understand. And so this is going to start to have some impact on our life. Because when we have this little taste or experience of impermanence or dukkha or no self or bodhicitta or emptiness, whatever, then that's going to be affecting our mind a little bit after the meditation in a good way. So we're going to start to notice a slight improvement in our life. But if we really want that to transform into a big improvement in our life, then we need to stabilize those experiences. We need to make sure that those little tastes and experiences of these things have a deeper impact on our mind, more lasting effect in daily life. And that is here realization. And of course, for this to become realization, then we need a very stable and clear mind for these experiences to penetrate deeper, to have a more lasting impact, hence shamatha practice. Now here within the emptiness practice, when we get to the stage of realization, then there are two levels of realization. There is the conceptual realization of emptiness, and then there's the non-conceptual or direct realization of emptiness. Meaning that when we first come to realize emptiness, in that experience, there's still a sense that there's a me, the meditator, realizing this thing emptiness. There still appears to be this duality between the meditator and the object of meditation, emptiness. But as we deepen that experience, that apparent duality will collapse, we will come to a direct non-conceptual experience of emptiness. So here in the text, it says, the last slogan in the meditation, it says, place your mind on the basis of all the actual path. So here the basis of all, of course, is emptiness. Emptiness is the ultimate nature of all phenomena. Hence, it's the basis of all, the actual path. Meaning that by coming to deepen our experience and realization of emptiness, we can move along the actual spiritual path to enlightenment. So I'd like to briefly look at that now. And for this, I've got a chart, so maybe you can hand those out. So this is describing the Mahayana path to enlightenment. So I'd like to just briefly go through that, because that sort of comes up in a few places in the commentary later as well. So then we'll sort of know what the commentary is talking about. So what we can say is that there are sort of five very clearly defined stages along the spiritual path. In the first stage of the path here, everyone got a copy? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there should be a spare one here. The first stage of the path is the path of accumulation. So if we look here, number two, it says uncontrived renunciation bodhicitta. So of course we're talking about the Mahayana path to enlightenment. So to enter the Mahayana path, of course, we need to develop the aspiration for enlightenment. So we need to have bodhicitta. And here, the word accumulation is talking about the two accumulations. You know, we talked about the two aspects of the path, wisdom and compassion. Then the compassion side of the path, when it talks about accumulating that, often we see the word merit. Merit is the result of our virtuous actions. So here the two, we're accumulating both sides of the path, wisdom and compassion. This is often called merit and wisdom. Merit's just another name for the result of all of our virtuous activities based on compassion. So here, of course, we are, as all the way along the path, we are putting a lot of effort into accumulating our wisdom, deepening our wisdom, and engaging in our virtuous activities based on bodhicitta. At the level of path of accumulation, then we have here, we've already developed shamatha, which means our experience of emptiness is conceptual. So we're having a conceptual realization of emptiness here. And this conceptual realization of emptiness can also be before we enter the path, which is what's mentioned here, number one. Number one says inferential realization of emptiness, sharp faculty trainees. So inferential is another word for conceptual, meaning that if we are a very sharp-minded trainee, then, and we've developed shamatha, we can have this conceptual realization of emptiness before we really fully develop bodhicitta. But certainly by the time we enter the path of accumulation, we will have this realization. So the conceptual realization of emptiness could be somewhere back here, but definitely also by here we will have that. Then, the next stage of the path, it says path of preparation. Here the word preparation means we are preparing for our first direct experience of emptiness. So here on the path of preparation, it's also a conceptual realization of emptiness. But here, we are deepening our realization of emptiness, meaning in that experience of emptiness, the apparent gap between me, the meditator, and emptiness, the objects, this apparent duality that seems to be there, collapses, or begins to collapse. Eventually, it completely collapses, and then we come to our first direct, non-conceptual realization of emptiness, which brings us to the third stage, path of seeing. So seeing here means seeing emptiness directly. And when we realize emptiness directly, then, as what's mentioned here, number seven, it says, initial direct realization of emptiness, Arya. Meaning there are two types of practitioner. There's the ordinary practitioner And then there's the Arya being. An Arya is simply someone who's had a direct realization of emptiness. So this word Arya comes up a few times in the commentary. So again, an Arya being is anyone who has had a direct realization of emptiness. This point in the spiritual path is very significant for many reasons. One reason being that when we have that first direct realization of emptiness, we're on a one-way ticket out of samsara. Of course, one realization of emptiness will not get us to nirvana, but it's really a sort of irreversible point in the spiritual path. To get out of nirvana, to get out of samsara to nirvana, of course, we need to get rid of these afflictive obscurations, ignorance and all the mental afflictions. To do that, we need to realize emptiness directly again and again and again and again and again, many, many times, to slowly wipe out all the ignorance and mental afflictions. That's what we do over the fourth stage of the path, path of meditation. And this part, the word meditation here, of course, can be a bit misleading. It doesn't mean we're just starting to meditate here. The word meditation, of course, coming from Sanskrit is bhavana. And bhavana means to cultivate, to familiarize. So what we're doing over this stage of the path is we are cultivating and familiarizing ourselves again and again and again with the direct realization of emptiness we had on the path of seeing. And this path of meditation is divided into 9 sections. That, together with the path of seeing, is 10 sections, which here are called the 10 grounds or the 10 bhumis in Sanskrit. And over the first 7 grounds, we are eliminating these afflictive obscurations, ignorance and all the mental afflictions. So by the time we get to the 7th ground, we have eliminated all afflictive obscurations, all of our ignorance, all mental afflictions and all the suffering they produce, which means now we have achieved the goal of nirvana. However, of course, we still have these very subtle stains of ignorance in our mind that cause this mistaken dualistic appearance. These are extremely difficult to get rid of. This is what we get rid of over the 8th, 9th and 10th ground. So these are, again, what's called the cognitive obscurations, these subtle stains in our mind that cause this mistaken dualistic appearance. Once we get rid of those over the last 3 grounds, then, of course, we reach the 5th stage of the path, which is called here Path of No More Learning. And, of course, we achieve then the goal of enlightenment. So, again, just to summarize all of that, based on these stages we go through. So now, first, of course, we need to try to understand what emptiness is, to get some framework for practice. We apply that in practice. We try to meditate on emptiness. We have some little taste or experience of emptiness. And then as we deepen our shamatha practice, as we develop a more stable and clear mind, once we've developed shamatha, and then we apply that level of mind to investigating and coming to experience emptiness, then that experience of emptiness becomes a conceptual realization of emptiness, which also, of course, may happen before we enter the Mahayana path before we develop bodhicitta. But if it doesn't, then by the time we develop bodhicitta and we're in the path of accumulation, then we have developed shamatha, and then we will have this conceptual realization of emptiness within this stage of the path. And then as we meditate on emptiness through the path of accumulation preparation, it's still conceptual. There's still this sort of sense of duality in our experience. But as that experience deepens, then that apparent duality between the meditator and emptiness, the object, collapses, and we come to our first direct non-conceptual realization of emptiness. Then we enter into the path of seeing. We become an Arya being. And if we're on the Mahayana path, of course, we become an Arya Bodhisattva. Then we continue to have direct non-conceptual realizations of emptiness along the various stages of path of meditation, and thereby wiping out more and more ignorance, mental afflictions through that direct realization of emptiness. When we get to the end of the seventh ground, we've wiped out all ignorance and mental afflictions, all suffering. We've gone beyond samsara, we have achieved nirvana. But then we continue to realize emptiness directly, more and more and more. And then slowly we were wiping out these very subtle stains of ignorance, these cognitive obscurations. Eventually we achieve the goal of enlightenment. In the enlightened state, of course, then we have wiped out all these subtle stains of ignorance in our mind, which means an enlightened being, when they look out on the world does not appear to be independent of them. They do not have this mistaken dualistic appearance. Of course, to try to understand what that really is, that experience, is beyond us, because we've never had that experience. This is you can only have this experience at the time of enlightenment. Before that, you simply alternate between seeing this phenomenal world, which appears to be dualistic, and then you alternate between that and the realization of emptiness. It's only when we become enlightened do we see the phenomenal world in a correct way, and we're realizing emptiness simultaneously. So that's very briefly the Mahayana path chart. Any questions on that before we go for a short morning tea break?
The first stage is saying ordinary bodhisattva.
Yeah. Correct.
So, because you become bodhisattva when you...
Bodhicitta.
When you have...
Bodhicitta.
For that, you have to do some rituals, isn't it?
No.
Okay, so just with the aspiration, we can be like that?
So remember, number two says uncontrived renunciation bodhicitta. What does uncontrived bodhicitta mean? It means now we can sit down, we can do this seven cause and effect or the exchanging self with others techniques, and then we have for a little moment, we have this sort of little, quite not so strong aspiration. I want to really achieve enlightenment for the welfare of others. You know, that may arise a little bit in our meditation. But then, of course, we get out of the meditation and then we get angry at people, and so this bodhicitta mind sort of quickly evaporates. It may come up a little bit from time to time in daily life. It may come up, you know, we may see some suffering, and then for a little moment we might think, oh, I really want to get to enlightenment so I can really help them. But, you know, it's like that. So that's what's called contrived, meaning we have to sort of think about it for it to come up. If we continue to reflect and meditate on this, we'll get to the point where this aspiration for enlightenment for the welfare of others will spontaneously and continuously arise throughout the day. Meaning that's spontaneously our motivation in all of our activities. That's when we enter the path of accumulation. That's uncontrived.
But even on that stage, we are not right, gone to any teacher yet, and maybe we can go, but it's not like we haven't done vows or...
So remember, in all levels of the practice, I really don't like to use this word vow, because often, you know, particularly maybe from a Christian background, you hear the word vow, you think, ooh, there's some things there that I'm supposed to not do, and I don't really want to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like, oh, these are things I don't want. Mm-hmm. Rather, these things are better called, as they're called here, precepts. They're there to help us, support us in our practice. These, if you want to call them vows or precepts, doesn't matter. But what they are little statements that help us to avoid straying from our practice. So these are things we need to remember to avoid going against our spiritual practice. So they're there as support for our practice. And we can have those vows or precepts at every level. So we can, at the Four Noble Truths level, they're called pratimoksha vows or precepts. At the bodhisattva level, they're called bodhisattva vows. At the vajrayana level, they're called tantric vows. But again, they're all short statements to help us, support us in our practice. Yeah, path is mind. Yeah, so it's path is in Mahayana path, mind. Path is the mind that is conjoined with bodhicitta, is Mahayana. For path, on the Theravada path to Nirvana, path equals mind conjoined with renunciation. Any other questions?
Here, the path of meditation number 8.
Yeah.
How would you define the active prayer?
The first six, as you can see, generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration, wisdom, are the six perfections. So the six perfections are, again, also listed in that order. And at that point is when we perfect that practice. So what does it mean to perfect that practice? I remember, I think one of them, the ethics. To perfect ethics means to that point is to the point where we don't even have a non-virtuous thought in a dream. Not even in a dream. That's when we get to the second ground. That's what it means to perfect ethics. And I can't remember exactly what the other, how to perfect them. And so then prayer, power, exalted wisdom, again, I studied this a long time ago, but I can't remember exactly what that is. But it is also in terms of some sort of practice. But I'd have to look up my notes to see what, remember what prayer, power, and exalted wisdom, I think, is about emptiness. But prayer and power, I can't exactly remember what those words relate to at that stage. The word Rinpoche means precious one. And as we progress in the spiritual path, we'll get to a point where we can sort of navigate our way through the rebirth process. Certainly once we've got to the path of seeing, we've wiped out any karmic imprints to take uncontrolled rebirth. So an Arya Bodhisattva is not taking rebirth through their karma. They're taking rebirth through their aspiration. But even well before that, then, well, at any level of the spiritual path, if we put a lot of effort into the spiritual path in this life, then a lot of the imprints of our practice, of course, go with us to the next life. Meaning that if you can somehow trace where a particular practitioner has ended up, particularly if that practitioner is already quite developed, and then you identify that person as a child, and then you provide that child with very good conditions as they're growing up, then by the time they reach their teenage years and their brain is fully developed, a lot of these imprints will start to ripen, meaning that that person as a teenager does a little bit of study and then all of a sudden all these things start happening because of all of their previous work. So in the Tibetan system, they try to recognize these people because if they can get them when they're young and protect them and provide good conditions, then as a young adult, they can already be back to the same level. And in that way, they're precious to us. That's what the word Rinpoche means, precious one. That person, even as a teenager or young adult, can be a highly qualified teacher for us. So that's what the Rinpoche system is about.
So as soon as somebody is called Rinpoche, he's one of those, like Lama Tsoka Rinpoche? Is it
technically, yes, but unfortunately, any system, of course, is open to abuse. For example, historically in Tibet, if a monastery had one or more Rinpoches, the community would give more money. Because my monastery's got these high-level practitioners, so I'll give more money. That monastery doesn't, so I'm not going to give any money to them. So it was open to abuse. So we should not automatically assume that if someone now has got the title Rinpoche, that they actually are high-level practitioner. But technically, that's what the word would imply. But again, whether someone's called Rinpoche this or Tulku that or Lama this doesn't matter. We should use the same approach. Check them out. Are they qualified or not? So that's the advice always given. But yes, technically yes, someone who's correctly been labeled Rinpoche would be that person. But unfortunately, I think that there are a number of cases where it's been abused and the label is just given for other reasons. Okay. So when we certainly, I mean, already if we have some taste, certainly conceptual realization of emptiness, from that, then we will have, when in daily life, because of that experience, this is a valid experience, even though it's not direct. For even from this, you will find that you will really start to question appearances. I mean, right up until we become enlightened, even a 10th level bodhisattva, when they look at the world still appears to them to exist independent of them. But of course, they never believe it. So even at an early stage, at the beginning of the Mahayana path, where we have a conceptual realization of emptiness, even there, you will find that that conceptual realization will at least be helpful for us to question these appearances. There may still be some grasping, but very much less, and then the mind, that realization will really help us to not really accept appearances. Certainly when we've had a direct realization of emptiness, then this grasping onto really gets very much reduced. But it's only again at the end of the seventh ground that we've got rid of all grasping. So it's only an eighth, ninth or tenth level bodhisattva that sees conventionalities as what's called mere conventionalities. Even though to them, things still appear independent. But now they've got rid of all grasping because they're in got nirvana. So they never have any grasping to that. So they 100% of the time see them as illusory-like. Early on, we can see them as illusory-like, but still there's some grasping happening. Well, no, you're convinced. I mean, certainly if you're path of seeing, you've seen the truth directly. Yeah. Well, I think even a conceptual realization is quite a conviction, yeah? But the mind of grasping is still quite strong, so there's this sort of like this. It's only when we get to the seventh ground where there's no grasping. So then an eighth, ninth, or tenth level bodhisattva sees phenomena as illusory-like 100% of the time.
In this chart, it looks like a linear process, but, for example, Gautama, when he was awakened by himself, he skipped some parts.
Skipped? No. It depends which philosophical system is talking about that, but I think they all talk about that even Gautama went through these stages, but maybe quite quickly. You know, maybe even a lot of this he went through. I think at least one of the philosophical systems that I've followed or read is that he was sort of on, when he sat down under the Bodhi tree, he was sort of on the path of preparation, and then he went through the whole lot in one sitting. But that's just one philosophical system opinion. Shortcut. Oh, okay. It's time for morning tea break, so let's have a tea break and then we'll come back.